Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Hey, it's another Wildlife Wednesday, and there's lots going on in the wildlife area this time of the year. Scott Craven joining us again, Meredith's UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He and I have been doing this program together for a long, long time, and he's back to talk about a lot of news coming out of the Wisconsin DNR. He'll also take your questions about wildlife you're seeing, and you can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email with a question or even a photo to talk@wpr.org. We sometimes get some pretty cool wildlife photos when Scott's on board. And looking forward to talking with him. Scott, welcome back.
Yes, Larry, I'm here, and welcome to you as well and to all our listeners. It's a wonderful time of year and a wonderful stretch of weather, so there's lots of wildlife activity to talk about.
Yeah, there's lots. I mean, migratory birds come to mind. Resident and migratory birds can be, you can see them all over the place now.
Well, this is a great time. If you're a seasoned birder, this is a great time of year. If you're a would-be birder or aspiring to get into it, this is the time to be out there, as all the birds are, a lot are already here. The big waves of warblers are yet to come, but all the birds are in their spring finery and their breeding plumage, so they're brightly colored. The leaves aren't fully out yet. The bugs aren't out. It's just
perfect.
A great time to be out watching these birds. We've had all sorts of stuff at our feeders for the last few days, and almost every day brings something new. I had the first hummingbird yesterday, so that's kind of cool. So everything will be close behind them, and people feel kind of protective about the birds in their yard or their feeders. And I think the human mindset is such that when my rose-breasted grosbeak pairs came back 3 or 4 days ago, it was, oh, our grosbeaks are back. That must be Frank and Sarah or whatever, because it's not necessarily the same birds, but they may have been related and so on, and they could be the same birds. So lots of interesting speculation that make people feel good.
Kaylee, who has an office right next to mine here at Wisconsin Public Radio, was showing me some photos. She just put one of those little cameras, things you can put up on your feeder and take a photo or get a nice close-up. And she was showing me photos of her cardinal and at least a couple of other birds. I can't remember the others, but the cardinal stands out. It's kind of a fun thing to have.
It is, and there's also a lot of interest in the various webcams that are around now.
Yeah.
So that you can dial up an eagle nest or something else and see what's going on in the life of the birds up close and personal. And of course, everybody's got a cell phone within easy reach. And frankly, the camera in my cell phone seems to be better than the cameras I used to lug around with all the related equipment. So it's very easy to get a picture when you have the opportunity, whereas it wasn't in the past. Not to mention waiting 2 weeks before your film was developed and you got it back. Maybe I'm dating myself, but anyway.
No, that's all right. Well, Rick in Minocqua witnessed, he wasn't looking at birds. I think he was looking at something else. Rick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. Hey, Scott. So I'm in Vilas County at the moment, but normally in New Glarus, and I got to concur with you guys on the birds. They're just all over the feeders in New Glarus, and we had a first hummingbird about 4 days ago before we left, and are up here for opening fishing. And on a lake, and kayaked yesterday or day before into an area, a bay that normally is kind of covered in lilies and kind of a lot of muck and stuff. So normally there's two or three beaver huts in this area. So just happened to go in there before the lilies start coming up. And what I saw was what I think was a mating ritual between two beavers, and I'd never seen anything like it. I was just all of a sudden taken aback by the rolling of two large, seemingly, brown animals just rolling it with each other in the water. And then all of a sudden, kind of tails come out of the water, and then heavy breathing, you could hear it. And then it would recur, and they'd be rolling, and you could see the humps of this, what I'm sure had to be a beaver, unless it was an otter. But it looked like there was two animals, looks like they were in a ritual of some kind. And I got a video of it, like Scott said, with these cameras. It's pretty good, but I was pretty unsteady in a kayak. But I got some video of it, and I looked it up, and it's extremely rare to see this. And there's nothing online that shows two animals rolling. And I saw some white in the underbellies of these things as they came up and rolled. Is that anything you're familiar with, Scott, or am I off?
Have we got some mating beavers there, Scott, or what?
Well, it's possible, but I was on board with the whole theory until you mentioned the white on the bellies. And,
yeah.
There's no white on the belly of either of those animals. So I'm not altogether sure what you were seeing, Rick. and it's often difficult whether they were beaver, otter, or something else. It's also sometimes difficult to distinguish mating behavior from aggressive behavior in terms of the wrestling and thrashing and so on and so forth. So, like I say, I was on board, but the bellies of both of those animals are relatively dark.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've got me somewhat mystified. But, hey, whatever you saw, it sounds like it was fun to observe and try and get a video of. So.
Yeah, really cool. But Rick, thanks for calling. Maybe somebody else will have an idea, too. I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. Possibly the light made it appear that the bellies were white.
Yeah, it might have been the reflection of the wet fur as well. But either way, otters or beavers, it could have been either one.
Thanks, Rick. Jude in Iola, your turn. Hi, Jude.
Hi. I've had an interesting last couple weeks. About 3 weeks ago, I got to experience the mating ritual of two sandhill cranes. And then the next thing after that is I had an eastern bluebird in the box. And then last week, I had a couple of the colorful, like the Baltimore Oriole and a grosbeak. And I didn't have the hummingbird yet, but I was sitting and talking to my sister on the phone outside, and I looked straight ahead, and there in the oriole finally is in the jelly, the male. And right after that, within about 5 minutes, I had that. The hummingbird came, and hovering up above me was a eagle. That just made it. That was within 5 minutes. And now I got the females coming in, and it's just, I think the only thing I don't have is the scarlet tanager and the buntings.
Oh, isn't it fun, Scott, to see?
It is, and just to kind of keep track, whether you do it formally and report your sightings for a big bird day or the birdathon that's going on or other activities that people get involved with, even if you don't have anything to do with that stuff, just being outside now and seeing all the colorful birds and watching what they're doing and providing grape jelly for the orioles and whatever else you may be doing, or sugar water for the hummingbirds. It makes everybody feel good about spring activity.
Yeah, it sure does. Thanks, Jude, for sharing that with us. And Mark in Wisconsin Dells has a question, I believe. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. A couple weeks ago, I talked to you, and I forgot to mention I was over by Hub City, which I am now, and there's two eagle nests, one on each side of the road. And every spring, the pair of eagles is up there in late winter and then has a successful nest, I think. Anyway, I've watched them for years. Well, 3 weeks ago when I went by to look up at the eagles, there was four geese up there in the nest. And I haven't seen the eagles back since. And I'm just wondering if geese would do something like that and chase the eagles away.
Canada geese, were they, Mark?
Yeah.
Canada geese in an eagle's nest.
Well, that's a bit unusual, Larry.
Yeah.
I've seen a goose in a tree occasionally, but they're a little awkward at that and generally don't have anything to do with trees. Nest on the ground. They'd have no interest in the eagle nest. And I'm not sure packing four adult Canada geese in an eagle nest would be a bit of a feat in and of itself. So
yeah, well, Mark's been watching it for years. That eagle nest, you know how it gets. They get bigger and bigger.
Oh, they're huge. Yeah, they're used traditionally for decades. But I don't know what the interest the eagles would have up there. Certainly not anything to do with food. No interest in the nest for usurping it to use for their own purposes. And, you know, even if that were happening, it would be one of the adults or a pair, not four. So that's an odd one. I guess I'd really like to see a picture of that one.
Yeah, I would as well. Mark, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we got an email from Vicky in Millidor, emailed to say that in March during a warm spell, she heard some spring peepers. And I love the sound of spring peepers. Here they are.
There they are, peeping.
She said after that there was snow and colder temperatures. She hasn't heard the spring peepers since, even when it has gotten into the 50s and 60s. Could the cold have killed some of them after they had started to come out of their frozen state? Or is Vicky worrying about nothing, she asks.
I don't think there's any particular concern. While they could have frozen, generally they are quite capable of, you know, staying in the water once things are thawed out a little bit, and should be fine. But it's the same situation in my little pond in the backyard. The various frogs have been calling now for a few weeks. In fact, I think the last time I was up at a cabin up in Price County, back on the 26th of April, there were a few half-baked croaks and calls going on until things began to warm up. But it's not uncommon at all for them to start fitfully and get a cold spell and simply clam up and disappear and then be back out again. Everything's going great guns here in the southern part of the state, but things may be a little slower up north. But I don't think Vicky needs to be worried about any major calamity or population decline. I think everybody in the chorus will join in at their normal position in the ranking, starting out with peepers and wood frogs and things like that, and then moving through leopard frogs and toads and ending up with bullfrogs, green frogs, and whatnot. So it'll all come. It's still reasonably early.
It is. You know, I love to hear the chorus frogs. Mm-hmm. That's always... Oh, there we go. That's a wonderful sound of spring.
It is, and it doesn't last very long, so you need to enjoy it while you can. The interesting thing for me, I've got chorus frogs and toads going in the little pond right now, and you can, if you're stealthy and approaching, you can still, they'll continue singing, but if they feel the slightest vibration or see any movement, boom, they're quiet, and boy, you can't find them. You know they're there, but spotting one is a real chore, so...
Rich in Two Rivers called in to say, and this had to do with the earlier caller about the two animals rolling together in the water. Rich said he observed that happening with snapping turtles. He's seen several times while paddling with them kind of rolling together in the water.
Well, that's true, but I've been thinking about this a little bit since we had that call from Rick, and I wonder too, Larry. You know, when he said he saw the white belly, the lighter underneath color is much more typical of a big fish than it is. I mean, if he's sure they were furry mammals, that's one thing, but I could imagine a couple of. I mean, certainly people are up all gathering up on the Wolf River to see the sturgeon activity or the muskies jumping over that little head dam on Lake Wingra here in Madison, or, you know, other species that may have been involved in some thrashing around in the water and would show a white belly.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think of that, Larry, but yeah. you've encountered a big fish every once in a while. Usually by accident, but...
I've had a few roll as they were fighting on my line. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. Big muskies. Was the Fuzzy in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Fuzzy.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wonder, Scott, if you could comment on the value of doing some habitat restoration along roadsides, either with prairie plantations, pollinator plantings, or else just minimizing mowing?
Well, it certainly, with all the emphasis on trying to help pollinators, things like No Mow May and other activities that people have the opportunity to engage in to provide pollinator habitat, roadside development, there are a lot of roadsides in Wisconsin. You start to think about the linear stretch and a 10 or 20 foot border, and all of a sudden that's a lot of acreage. It's been interesting to me to see kind of a resurrection of that mindset in terms of restoration of prairie vegetation or flower plantings or whatever, because there was a lot of that going on, and there were DNR programs involved with my predecessor at the university back in the 50s and 60s with some very active roadside management issues with restoring habitat. But it was my recollection that some of that fell out of favor as these roadsides grew up into dense vegetation. There were some problems associated with that. It compromised visibility as people were driving along. It also not only attracted pollinators, but lots of other animals that found that habitat of some interest for feeding or whatever. And therefore, it was much easier for anything from a fox or woodchuck up to a deer to all of a sudden bound out of the vegetation and boom, they were right there in the roadway. So I'm kind of curious. I haven't paid a great deal of attention to it the last few years, but I'm interested. You know, what they say is things, what goes around comes around. And that initial emphasis on roadside habitat management for conservation, wildlife, pollinators, and so forth kind of faded for a while and now seems to be enjoying a resurgence. I personally don't have any problem with it. I think if people are reasonably cautious, they can deal with the presence of animals near the roadside. But anyway, I just find it curious that it seems to be coming back.
Yeah, interesting. Fuzzy, thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him with us. And we have open lines now, so we can get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234. Or again, you could send an email or post a picture to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. A big thanks to everyone who donated during our spring member drive. Thanks a bunch. Support from people like, Spencer in Waukesha, Kathy in Holman. Folks like that make WPR's essential service possible. If you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your gift. Just go to WPR.org. You certainly play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. And thanks a lot for your partnership. Appreciate it very, very much. Scott Craven, our guest today, we're taking a look at the world of wildlife with him. And Marilyn emailed to say that anyone interested in birds, from beginners to seasoned birders, might want to check out the Horicon Marsh Bird Festival this weekend, May 9th through the 11th. Marilyn says it's a great event. And there are a lot of events going on right now, a number of birding events.
There are lots. In fact, you just heard, everybody heard the sponsor notification of the Birdathon taking place right now, going into June 15th. And that's run through the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. And it's essentially a fundraiser to support their conservation activities related to birds. So people have a lot of fun. It benefits birds in the meantime. As I looked up, as I was looking up festivals around, a couple have already passed. The Horicon Festival is coming up this weekend, but there are four or five more leading up to the end of the month, plus the Birdathon, plus all sorts of opportunities for people to get involved. The activities through eBird, for example, the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology site, and participation. If people doubt that this is a big deal, I was looking at the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is another popular activity that ended back in late winter, in mid-February, but they just tabulated all the data. Record number of participants in that activity, 830,000 global participants in over 200 countries. Wow. 830,000. And they detected, get this, it would be a big deal if you were really paying attention to the birds coming through Wisconsin. And collectively, we recorded, say, 350 species. That would be fantastic. The Great Backyard Bird Count globally produced 8,078 species.
Wow.
That's a significant majority of the world's birds. So and it, there are just millions of people involved, and they're willing to spend the time and the effort to participate and help the groups that are working with bird conservation collect the data they need to base their decisions on. So it we say it's popular for people to feed the birds or watch birds, but it's almost beyond that. It's staggering.
It's staggering. So, and I just meant Door County Festival of Nature is May 22nd through the 25th.
Yep.
If you happen to be in Shawamigan Bay area, birding and nature festival there the same weekend. So there is lots going on. As a matter of fact, the end of May, I'll be in Bayfield the 30th, I believe. We're broadcasting that from Bayfield in Bloom. So I'll be looking at the birds in Bayfield along about May 30th with Jill Nadeau and the whole gang. That'll be a lot of fun. And you can sign up for that, by the way, if you want to attend. It's a free event, but we like to have people register. And you can do that online, WPR.org, and sign up to attend that Bayfield and Bloom. Well,
maybe I'll see you there, Larry. I'll be up there a day or two later fishing.
Oh, well.
With a group of guys. So you never know what's going on. But, well, anyway.
It's WPR.org/presents. That's the spot to go to if you want to sign up for Bayfield and Bloom with Larry and the gang. That's going to be a lot of fun. Well, let's see. Spring turkey hunt. I bet you that there's some. That's not a gobbler. Jeff was going to give me a gobble. No, we're not here. There it is.
Goes.
You know, that's the fun part about it. You'll hear other bird songs, but then that gobble comes up.
That you hear that sound when you're out in the woods looking for turkeys. That gets your blood pumping pretty quickly. And boy, there's been a lot of it going on. From what I'm hearing, the spring turkey season has been going very, very well. The third weekly hunting period, and I think they started on April 16th, the third one, period C, ended yesterday, and period D of the sixth, the fourth of sixth, started this morning. And boy, from everything I hear, people are doing very well. Turkeys are being harvested, and we could be on our way to another 50,000 bird plus harvest, which hasn't happened much in recent years. There was some concern about what's happening to our turkey numbers, but things seem to be going very well this time around. So,
yeah.
including for my family, it was back on the youth turkey hunt, which was back in mid-April, I think the 13th and 14th. I had grandson from Colorado, grandson from here in Verona, and my son and I and son-in-law, and we kind of went out to his deer hunting land in Grant County, my son-in-law's land, and set up a turkey camp. And the boys went out with their dads early that first morning, and by 9 o'clock, both were back at the camp with great big gobblers, and it was they were a couple of excited kids. First turkey for both of them, and it was a spectacular weekend weather-wise and from the standpoint of turkey hunting and the kids having a good time. And it's just continued right on in. People have been sending me lots of pictures of big gobblers, and I was planting a few things in the garden this morning, and there was a big tom in a little field I've developed for them to strut in on the property. And he was out there in full strut, just prancing around and no more than, I don't know, 90 or 100 yards from us planting seeds and not trying to be inconspicuous, but he was not the least bit troubled. And so anyway, that's an example, though, as you said, Larry, of if you're outside, and quiet or fully camouflaged like a turkey hunter would be, you'll see all sorts of neat stuff this time of year, from turkeys gobbling to pheasants crowing, rough grouse drumming, all the songbirds singing, and on and on and on. And if you're quiet and camouflaged, they will not know you're there. So
yeah.
Anyway, again, it's another reason why it's such a great time to be outside.
Tom in Green Bay has something relating to turkeys, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I live just outside Green Bay, and we got 15 acres in there. A guy was turkey hunting this morning, and he got a turkey, a nice one, about 25 pounds. And after he shot it, the turkey went down. Four other turkeys came out of the brush line, four other toms, and made a tight circle around that dead bird. What the Sam Hill's going on with that?
A turkey circle.
It's pretty common if there are multiple gobblers coming into a hunter calling or whatnot, and they're either coming to the hunter's decoy, especially if they're using a gobbler decoy or a jake, that they may be coming in with the intent of attacking it. And whether they get to the decoy or not, let's say there's a couple gobblers coming in, or in this case there were three or four, and one is shot, turkeys rarely, they're kind of like the proverbial chicken with the head cut off. Usually they, even with a completely mortal wound, there's still some flopping and thrashing around. And for whatever reason, that activity incites the other birds present to often attack the downed gobbler and peck it, or use their spurs to attack and spur it. And usually it takes the movement of the hunter or whatnot to give the other turkeys the idea, well, this isn't such a great idea, guys, let's get out of here, and then they'll take off. But it's not uncommon at all for them to approach a bird that's knocked down. It's not like they're there saying, well, what happened to Frank here? Frank, are you okay? And they're there for whatever instinctive approach. And the gobblers are competing with each other at this time of year. I mean, they're all trying to breed and to successfully pass on their genes. So it's not uncommon for them to attack or chase each other. And that's usually what motivates them gathering around a downed bird.
Yeah. So, there you go, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling.
It's weird, but they'll do it.
John and Baronet, we go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I've been waiting for Scott to come back on. I saw two birds. I'm 75 years old, so I've been around this part of the country for a while. Two little birds that I've never seen before. And when I first spotted them, they were heading from the swamp up into a tree by the side of the road. I thought, wow, those are big hummingbirds. And then I thought, wait a minute. They're like more than twice the size of a hummingbird, but they're the same shape as a hummingbird, built like a cigar. I mean, long, thin bird. Same type of tail feathers, but a shorter, stouter beak. And they were just kind of a gray, tan, sparrow-colored, wren-colored, something like that. Wondering if you guys had any idea what I saw there.
How long or how big was the bird?
They were at least twice the size of a hummingbird, maybe three times.
Boy, that could be a lot of birds.
It certainly could be. And you mentioned gray. Would you describe them as uniform gray?
Yeah, I suppose
there are a lot of gray birds, but I just, what came to mind to me, that's a modest sized bird, but has a stouter but sharp beak. That one of my favorite birds to see around the yard is a gray catbird, and they're often seen in pairs. There are a lot of possibilities here, John. I don't think we're going to be able to pin anything down for you without a little more information, photographs, something like that. There are a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I like the catbird idea, though, Scott. That's a possibility, for sure. You need to get a picture, John.
Sorry, Johnny. We're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of bird species out there, and a lot are small and can be very frustrating for birders. These birds are often lumped into categories like little brown birds for a lot of the sparrows and so forth, or the warblers when they've changed plumage in the fall, and they are really tough to identify.
Yeah.
And if you thought hummingbird size, something in the warbler arena, which are all relatively tiny birds like chickadee size, in fact, a chickadee's gray, too, for that matter, but has some white and black on it. So I'm sorry we can't give you anything definite, John, but there's too much turf to cover here.
John, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Erica in Crab Lake, we'll go to you. Hi, Erica.
Good morning. Let me tell you, surf's up on Crab Lake. It is blowing out here. But my question is, I live in Lake Tomahawk, actually, and 25, 30 years ago when we first built, we would see red-bellied woodpeckers just for a week. They were just listed as a kind of a pass-through migrator. Now we've got a breeding pair, and it's just so cool. Except for their kids are ugly. they're not as ugly as a pileated, but you know, they're right up there. But I don't know if that, would you call that global warming or just, I don't know, what, a trend?
Just luck. And Crab Lake, which Crab Lake are you? Where are you located? There's more than one Crab Lake.
Oh, it's up by Presque Isle.
Okay, Presque Isle.
Yeah. Well, that's a ways up there. I mean, you can track in birds like Wisconsin birds, a seasonal and geographic distribution. You can track the observations by month of any species you're interested in to see what the probability of observation is in your home county. So there are ways you can get some idea of the rarity of the sighting. Red bellies are common around me down here. I've got a couple pairs that come to the suet feeder regularly. I think they're one of our prettiest birds. And among the woodpeckers, next to a red-headed, which have become quite unusual, I think the red bellies are right near the top. So you're lucky to have them around, but they are a lot less common up in the North Country. And there are ways through books like that one I mentioned, Seasonal and Geographic Distribution of Birds in Wisconsin, or some of the records from the online sites like eBird or the mapping sites like Nature Mapper that's run by, what's the Nature Center that runs that, Larry? Do you remember over in the near Eau Claire? I don't remember, but I think you could find that online. And again, there was our records maintained by county, and you can get some idea of the frequency or likelihood of virtually any natural event that you might be seeing.
Yeah. Eric, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Gina emailed to say they live in a suburban area right outside Madison. About a month ago, Gina and her husband heard some loud screeching noise coming from the field across their road, got a closer look to see, and it was two animals fighting, one a squirrel, the other was dark, almost black in color, and it killed the squirrel and dragged it away. They're thinking it was a mink and wonder if that would make any sense. Are they common around Madison? Her husband took a video, but it's difficult to see as he didn't want to get too close to the action.
Did you say this occurred at night, Larry? No.
No, it was daytime.
Okay. Well, a small dark animal certainly could have been a mink, and they might do that. Of course, down here in the south, we've had more sightings in recent years of a larger dark animal that would also kill a squirrel, and that would be a fisher. But that would be even more unusual than the mink, but both possible. Did Gina say anything about the relative size of the animals? Did it seem like it was an even fight between the squirrel and the darker animal, or no?
No.
Well,
They were guessing mink, so maybe, I would guess mink rather than fisher.
Yeah, and if her question was, are they found around here? Yes, they're surprisingly common, not seen frequently, but they're around. I've seen them around my yard here south of Madison in the town of Oregon. And I remember one of my favorite wildlife encounters ever was on campus, walking from Russell Labs, where my office was, back up toward the Union along the Lakeshore Path. And as I was walking along, I think this was in the morning, I encountered a family of mink along the lakeshore there. And it was mom and, I don't remember, five or six little ones. And the little ones, they were very curious. And they came right over to me. And at one point, I had one juvenile mink sitting on the toes of each of my two shoes looking up at me, trying to say, what the heck is that thing? And they eventually thought better of it and scattered with mom back to the rocks on the lakeshore. But they certainly are around. And they could have been involved in what Gina witnessed. So,
Tony in Mount Horeb has a question for you. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Got a question. We have a small, meaning in Mount Horeb, a third acre lot that we're going to be building a house on in an older neighborhood. It's next to the bike trail, so it is kind of a bunch of shrubs and so on along that line to the back of the lot, but I like to establish a frog pond when we start building. Does that end up being a lot of work and maintenance, or and can you have a source, a booklet, or something from Extension, perhaps, to recommend?
I think the good news, Tony, this can be a do-it-yourself project. And I built several of them over the years. The starting point is a liner, rubber or fabric liner that are readily available in a whole variety of sizes. And you dig a hole in the shape and size that interests you or that fits your yard, line it, and then you can put in a recirculating pump or landscape it any way you want. Or you can go to any of our local building centers and get a prefabricated pond in the shape of a kidney shape or oblong or whatever, again, strikes your fancy. And these come in various sizes, kind of like these little round blue kitty or colored kitty swimming pools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for that matter, you could use one of those too, set it in the ground and then put a darker liner in it and start with that. So you can either do it yourself, dig it, fill it, and so forth, and then go from there, or most of the big landscape companies around Dane County, I think probably statewide, there are a number of companies now that will produce a pond for you. And in my case, for example, I got tired of digging the holes, and I'm old and fragile now. So when we decided a couple of years ago that we wanted to upgrade our pond in the backyard, and not only for frogs, fish, anybody else who was happening to come in, but we liked the water movement and sound. So I simply bid it out to one of the local landscapers, and they brought in a crew and heavy equipment with the capability of moving boulders that there's no way I was going to move them around. And they worked at it for 3 or 4 days and produced what I think is a beautiful pond with a three-tiered stream and waterfall system that drops into it, and a recirculating pump that works the whole thing, and interior lights and landscaping and so forth. And in addition, because I was interested in frogs, I also had them inset one of these little prefabricated ponds right next to it that I was able to fill with plant materials. And I don't know how I still am mystified by how it happens, but the frogs somehow find that pond. I think I've had over the 3 or 4 years that pond's been in place, and I'm surrounded by prairie restoration and on a hill. So it's not exactly frog country, but I've had 7 different species of frogs in that pond, and there's probably 4 in there right now. The chorus frogs, the toads, the peepers, and there's 2 bullfrogs.
Wow.
And a green frog. And
where do they come from?
How they find the pond. Now, in the case of the bullfrogs, I've been, well, you know some of the stories about the bullfrogs I've had over the years, Larry.
Yeah.
But I think there was 1 or 2 in there that I actually procured and put in. but everything else is found it naturally. So bottom line, Tony, there are many ways you could end up with a pond. I recommend it highly. You'll have all sorts of things besides frogs. And if you go with a professional company or one of the pond companies, they can fix you up with the hardware, the pumps and tubing and assorted other things, the chemicals that can be added to control algae and keep the water clear, and a whole host of other tips, which will benefit not only the frogs, but a whole bunch of other things. I had two turkeys drinking out of the pond this morning while we were having breakfast, and especially when it's dry like it is now and we're entering a prolonged dry spell, a lot of things depend on those little ponds that people have. So I recommend it highly. It's doable in many different ways, and you can go from the expensive, relatively more expensive contracting approach or the do-it-yourself effort. But I really found dealing with the experts to be useful. I didn't know, for example, I put this little plastic pond in and told the people who were here, yeah, I'm interested in frogs. Well, said, you know, they need a certain depth of water to overwinter in. And he said, what will really help the frogs, he said, go to a discount supply place and get a huge bag of kitty litter and dump that in the pond. I said, what? Well, anyway, it turns out that kitty litter, at least some of it, is extruded clay. And he said it'll sink right to the bottom, no cloudy water, it won't look muddy. It'll sink to the bottom and swell up, and there'll be a layer of this goo on the bottom of the pond. And, boy, the frogs really like to snuggle down into that for the winter. And I've had no problems overwintering my frogs since I did that. So sometimes it pays to consult with folks who know what's going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tony, that was a long answer, but give it a try. You'll like it.
Tony, thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. Just to let you know, at the bottom of the hour, we will be taking a look at a new glacial geology map. I've seen it. It is a dandy, and we'll be talking with a couple of geology professors about that map. Right now, though, the world of wildlife with Scott, and Joe in Eau Claire County has something for us. Joe, hello.
Hello. Yeah, this isn't exactly why I called, but I caught part of the comment from a previous caller about habitat in Eau Claire County. And we have up here a management plan. I guess we're part of a statewide management plan for Karner blue butterflies. And there's little signs along the roadsides that signify where people are supposed to mow. I think this is on the county forest land. And they want to mow it so the trees don't come in, but they want to do it late in the summer so that you're not chopping up the butterfly caterpillars. So that is perhaps what the caller was calling about.
Yeah, could well be, Joe. Scott, comment?
No, but it's quite possible to, I think, have your cake and eat it too, especially in the case of butterfly management, as Joe just pointed out. If you time the road maintenance properly, is not as detrimental. Mowing would not be as detrimental to the populations like of Karner blues as it would otherwise. It's really no different than if you've got conservation reserve grasslands. The timing of any mowing is critical to let ground nesting birds do their thing before the mowing equipment comes in. So all of this is... you need to know what you're doing so that it's done right.
Yeah.
Mowing can be very detrimental, but it can also be accomplished and not be detrimental depending on the species in question.
Chris in Verona, we go to you next. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Larry and Scott. I have an observation and then a question for both of you. A couple of weeks ago, I was out with my son helping my father-in-law out in Fenimore. He has a farm out there, and we were just clearing some brush along a fence row, and I hear my son go, whoa, and I look over, and there's this, I'm assuming it's a field mouse. It had a little bit larger ears than your typical house mouse, But the interesting thing was that there were four young babies latched on. I assume they were suckling, and we interrupted them, and the mother mouse just dragged them up a small little tree with them just continuing to hold on. It was quite a scene. And then my question is in regards to bobcats. I have my son just actually texted me last night. He lives in Viroqua and said he spotted one last evening out in a wildlife area. And I live in Verona, and I have a neighbor who's a couple blocks away from us. He's his house is adjacent to a park, and he has a field camera out there, or a trail camera, and he also took a picture of a bobcat. So my question is there a resurgence of the bobcat population in Wisconsin? And if so, just kind of curious what might be helping out the population.
Hmm. Thanks.
Okay, well, for the interesting observations, first of all, Chris, the field mouse was probably a white-footed mouse. Most people know them as field mice, white-footed mouse or deer mouse. There's a couple different species, but they have white bellies, and they, in particular, the white-footed mouse are excellent climbers, and they'll often nest in an abandoned or have their young in an abandoned bird nest that they kind of dome over and occupy that. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it climbed very well and the young were hanging on for dear life. Interesting thing to see. As far as the bobcats are concerned, it's not as much a resurgence of the population in the state as it is an extension or expansion of the population into southwestern Wisconsin. And this has been going on for quite a while. So it's not at all unusual anymore to have the observations that you've made of bobcat photos on trail cameras or encounters with them or whatnot. The DNR in the last year or so has completed what they call their southwestern deer study, where they were also working with various predators, scavengers, and so forth, and they caught lots of bobcats as part of that study in southwestern Wisconsin in the Driftless area. So I wouldn't say they're necessarily all over the place, but they're certainly not an oddity anymore, and they're doing very well. So, and they probably are not there because of anything we did. That's a normal range extension, and the habitat is quite suitable for them. So bobcats in the southwestern part of the state are here to stay.
Yeah, they are indeed. Chris, thank you so much for calling. Scott, I don't know if you got a video yet of, and if you haven't or haven't had a chance to look at it, but there's a video of a dark-colored animal running off with a squirrel in its mouth, and the listener wondering if it's a mink. And it's a little hard to say, and I tell you what, you can take a look at it over our news break, maybe, and then have a response when we come back from it. I did want to, someone else emailed, how does the harvest of turkeys help the population?
Well, it's not necessarily a matter of part of the management strategies to assist the turkeys as much as it is an opportunity for a very popular hunting experience all around the country. That is a relatively recent phenomenon in Wisconsin since turkeys were restored in the mid-1970s and have just gone gangbusters over way more of Wisconsin than we thought they'd occupy. So the turkeys are there, and because of their breeding behavior, where a mature gobbler may service or mate with a number of hens, the reduction of the gobbler or male population, and those are the only legal ones in the spring, bearded hen aside, that's a little off target here with our discussion. But the harvest of a significant number of gobblers, especially after they've participated in the mating process, really has no bearing on the population and provides a lot of recreational opportunity in terms of turkey hunting and then the meat and so forth without any necessary harm to or detriment to the population. So
on that note, we will take a quick look at the news, and then we will be back with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. continuing with our Wildlife Wednesday program here. Larry Mealer with my guest, retired UW Extension wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He's here to answer your questions about animals, wildlife, habitat, conservation efforts, all kinds of things. Give us a call with your questions or comments, or maybe an experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. It's talk@WPR.org. Scott, did you have a chance to look at that short video?
Yes, I did, Larry.
It was
a mink.
It looked like it to me. At first, I thought, well, it's got a big tail, but no, that was the squirrel's tail. It was, for those who are just tuning in, it was a listener sent us a short video of a dark-colored animal running off with a squirrel in its mouth and wondering if the animal was a mink. And the sender did not say where the video was shot, but I don't think it makes any difference.
No, mink are widely distributed, and it was, in my opinion at least, it was definitely a mink. And I guess that answers the question from Gina back a while back for the same kind of question where they saw two animals fighting, one of them dark. And so anyway, mink.
Yeah, mink for sure. Jeannie in Monona said they recently set up a good-sized bird bath in their yard under a large red oak tree, currently a sunny spot. They haven't seen much, if any, day activity compared to a smaller, more sheltered bird bath they have. However, they have found entrails and skin or fur pieces hanging over the side in the water. Any idea what bird might be using it for a meal site? I'm guessing it's some bird of prey. And is there any chance other smaller birds would use it in spite of the intermittent ghastly remains?
Well, that may be a little discouraging for a bird coming in to get a drink or take a bath, but that in years past, it was fairly common observation to find remains of prey from small mammals to other things, and usually that was attributed to crows.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, it does happen, and it's a little disconcerting and does affect water quality in the bird bath. So I think it's a matter of keeping a vigilant eye on the bird bath, and when it needs cleaning, clean it out, and the birds will eventually utilize it. The bigger, deeper bird baths, though, sometimes make the birds a little nervous if they can't, you know, bend over enough to just get a drink, and going into deeper water for a bath is problematic for them. So
yeah, absolutely. Dennis, and
if that's an issue, or if she wants to try something, you know, get a flat rock that will fit in the bath, but either be slightly exposed or just below the surface, so the birds have a little more surface area to work with.
Back to frogs for a minute. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to say frogs move a half a mile or more from rivers, and he's seen that. If they find a pond, they might live there, especially if they like it for hibernating. And you certainly would agree with that.
Absolutely. They can cover some ground.
Let's see. Jim and Mauston email. They shot one of two toms while 8 to 10 jakes stayed back out of harm's way. The jakes just attacked the downed tom and got their licks in. So that goes along with what you were talking about earlier. And Ken in Little Chute sent a photo of two turtles frolicking last spring at Hartman Creek State Park.
I saw that as well, Larry, and I guess frolicking is one interpretation, but there certainly could be others as well.
Oh, man.
Snapping turtles have a nasty disposition. I'm not sure frolicking fits into their their vocabulary very well.
Mark,
hey, Larry, if we get a chance, the opening of the fishing season and the final tally on the deer season may be of some interest to the listeners.
One more question, and before we go to that, Mark had emailed to ask if bat houses really work.
Well, absolutely, but I guess it depends on what the goal is. if, for example, people were thinking, oh, more bat houses would help bats in the face of white nose syndrome, the disease that's been so damaging, then that's probably not the case. But in terms of providing alternative housing for bats that are displaced from an attic or looking for a new colony site or whatnot, they certainly work and will be occupied. If folks who are trying to deal with an existing colony in a barn, shed, attic of a home or whatnot, are thinking they'll put up a bat house and the bats will voluntarily vacate a nice, comfortable, warm attic to live in a small box on the side of the house, that probably won't be the case. But in terms of providing roosting sites for bats, they work very well, and there are many different designs, and they've become very popular.
Let's turn our attention to fishing. I didn't get out for the opening weekend. My daughter was high jumping in her last track event on Saturday before she graduates from college, so I missed it. But how was the opening weekend for folks?
Well, good question. I missed it too, but not for as good a reason as you had, Larry. Actually, we were turkey hunting. Yeah, that worked out okay too. But the bottom line is, fishing is incredibly popular in Wisconsin, and there were a couple of things that have happened leading up to the opening day this past Saturday on the 3rd of May that people might be interested in. One is kind of the premiere of the Wisconsin Fishing Finder,
yeah.
Essentially a web-based resource that the DNR has created as a one-stop source to find information on fishing regulations, boat launch sites, access points for shore fishing, stocking information. Basically, it's designed to provide a fisher, especially perhaps a new one, not familiar with the area, you know, where the heck can I go?
Yeah.
And what are the relevant constraints or regulations or whatnot? And the reality is that website showcases we have 15,000 inland lakes, 42,000 miles of streams and rivers, and 1,000 miles of Great Lakes shoreline. There's lots of places to fish out there. So opening day, I'm anxious to get out. But especially now that it's warmed up a little bit, I was, and I guess I'm still call myself an avid trout fisherman, but the luster was taken off the trout opener for me when we went to the early season trout fishing, and you could essentially trout fish all winter leading up to almost the traditional opening day. It was catch and release, and it certainly does provide some more opportunity and so forth, but the excitement of that kind of Christmas morning mentality of, okay, everybody's heading out trout fishing, that just doesn't happen anymore, at least not for me.
Yeah. So. Well, speaking of opening days of deer hunting, I know you wanted to talk about the harvest. How was it compared to previous years?
Well, I'm reluctant to talk about deer season because it seems like a distant memory now. But in reality, the final numbers have just come out, and some of our outdoor writers have seized on those to make a couple of points that I think are very important. For one thing, despite some concerns over, hey, how are deer doing and so forth, for the 24 and into early 25 season, hunters bagged 321,844 deer, which was an 8% increase over 23-24, the previous collection of seasons. And coming off some seasons where there were declines and a bit of grumbling, this was good news in that regard. But there are some downsides here, and one of them that one of the outdoor writers made is a big point, and I think is critical here. Chronic wasting disease continues to spread. It's now found in 55 of our 72 counties. And while a record for buck harvest was set in, I think it was 13 counties, primarily in the central farmland, hunters in the hot spots for chronic wasting disease, like Iowa County and Richland County, which had historically been hotbeds of high deer harvest, for people in those two counties, they harvested deer at this in this previous season at historic low levels. And I think now people are acknowledging and seeing the results of that southwestern deer study that I mentioned that the DNR completed and just observations of landowners and hunters in areas where CWD is rampant, that it can and does have an impact on the populations. And I find that a little discouraging because it continues to spread. And I hope that the folks who are enjoying record harvests in some of our other counties, the future is the future has a shadow over it. So anyway, that was, I think, the telling point for this past season. It was a mild winter. It was a great season for harvest and for opportunity in some parts of the state, but it's still overshadowed, I think, by the spread of chronic wasting disease. So.
Yeah. You can join in, too. Open lines, get you on real quick here at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Lots of emails. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Jerry in Eau Claire emailed to say they have a 7-acre park in their neighborhood, about 3 acres of woods, and 3 acres is in prairie. About 1 acre is playground with a small ball field. Some critter is digging up the ball field at night, so nobody has seen what's doing the damage. It has dug up about 100-square-foot area. And in wondering what the heck could be doing this.
Well, it's often when turf, whether it's somebody's lawn or whatever, it's often skunks, which are active at night, and they're digging and rolling the turf looking for grubs that are near the surface, especially since we've had some recent rains. That may all come to an end here as this long dry spell takes hold. Raccoons may also be involved in that at some point, but skunks are the most likely culprit.
Yeah.
Have you been to, Larry, I just wanted to ask you a question. Have you been to a good movie lately? the reason I ask is the folks I work with at the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation down near Chicago have they partner with Ducks Unlimited and some other partners, and they're producing IMAX movies on conservation topics.
Oh.
And a couple of years ago, they released Wings Over Water, which dealt with the prairie potholes and duck production and other birds that depend on the prairie potholes in the upper Midwest and plain states. It was a huge success. And These are released to big screen theaters, IMAX theaters worldwide. A new one has just been released in the last couple of days, and it's called Secrets of the Great Salt Lake. Is narrated by Mike Rowe, that some people may recognize from the Dirty Jobs program on TV that was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, the Great Salt Lake is not in Wisconsin. It's a long ways away, but it's drying up. And that's a huge conservation issue for that area. This movie is coming out now. All I'm suggesting is for the listeners and you, Larry, if you hear about this at a big screen, usually in some of the larger cities, Wings Over Water was fantastic. I think the Great Salt Lake Secrets will be just as impressive, be a good thing to see. And they also distribute educational materials on these topics to about 10,000 American schools. And it's a big deal. And they have two or three more in production, one on salmon and a couple other topics. So they're really good if you get a chance to see them.
Yeah, Wings Over Water was great. No doubt about it. Bob in Stillwater has a question for you. Let's go there, or maybe a comment. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Earlier this week, I was sitting in my house eating supper, looking out the window, and there was a blanding turtle walking by my garage on the concrete. He stuck his neck out, looked at the garage door, and it was shut. He kept on walking and looked at the other garage door, which was also shut, and he just kept walking along. I live probably a good third of a mile from any kind of water. It's just a little pond. How far does something like that travel?
Oh, the turtle, any turtle, whether it's a painted turtle, snapping turtle, or whatever, especially in the spring when they're wandering around, either it's a female looking for a site to lay her eggs, although it's a little early for that, or just looking for something changed in the habitat they or environment they were in, and they're looking for a new home. They can wander. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of them move a mile or more.
Yeah.
So it happens, and they look out of place, but they seem to know They seem to know where they're headed, or at least they know what they're looking for, and then they need to intersect it, whether it's by chance or by design. But I doubt that it had much interest in your garage, you know, unless it was looking for shade or something. But Blanding's turtles are, you know, a bit on the unusual side, and hopefully it found a new home.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Luke in central Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Larry. Thank you again for taking my call. I know you guys talked about woodpeckers earlier in the show. I was wondering, we live on a family farm, about 180 acres with a river that runs through it in central Wisconsin. And we hear this woodpecker when we're out and about in the fields, you know, doing spring work. And it hits so fast. It's literally like, you know, like 30 beats or 30 hits a second. Do you have any idea what kind of woodpecker that might be?
Well, probably marking some territory.
Yeah, I mean, most of the common smaller ones, the downy hairy and so forth, can rap on a tree with amazing rapidity. I thought you were headed down the road of one that people often hear in the spring and complain about, is the yellow-bellied sapsucker, and they have a very distinctive kind of a rapid beat, and then it tails off and becomes a degree of and so forth. And that's typical of a sapsucker. People are unhappy about them because they do a fair bit of tree damage. They're doing the digging to attract or the sap. You got a call there, Larry?
We had a call of something, yeah. But I'm not sure what it was.
I don't know what it was.
Oh, the yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Yeah, they also call, but their tapping sequence is very distinctive, and that's where I thought you were headed. But they end that rapid sequence you were referring to with a very slow and deliberate tapping before they quit.
Interesting.
Easiest way when you hear that, Luke, in the woods, you know, work your way toward it, especially with a pair of binoculars, and you'll see who's up, who's at it.
Yep, you will indeed. Luke, thank you. Tim and Toma, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Glad to talk to you.
Well, glad
here's
to have you
situation.
On.
Oh, yeah, here's a situation I ran into. I'm an interstate trucker. I went on vacation for 2 weeks. I came back. I picked up my truck Saturday. I went to make a pickup. And when I got into Chicago, on the back of my truck, there was a bird's nest with three robin's eggs in it.
Oh.
So I said, well, you know, the mother must be looking crazy, saying, what happened to not only the eggs, but the truck and the nest and everything? So I got back to where I had parked it, and I took the nest off and put it at a tree, maybe 100 yards away. Now, out of curiosity, is the mother going to stay around and look for it, or is this a lost cause where it, everything has moved on?
I don't want to be a downer here, Tim, but my suspicion is that that's a lost cause, and that the bird doesn't necessarily mean it moved on and left the area, but it may have moved on. Birds lose their nests for a whole variety of reasons: predators, windstorms, and a variety of other things. And you know, unlike humans, there's not a mourning period or any awareness of that. It's just, the nest is gone. The instinct is that there's kind of a recycling period, and all of a sudden they re-nest. And she'll have another nest and another clutch of eggs, and hopefully raise them successfully. And all is well that ends well as far as that robin's concerned for the year. She's done her thing. But I think the likelihood that with that nest being disappeared for a period and then being restored, that robin is going to find it and know what it is and so forth, probably not likely.
Thank you very much for calling, Tim. Appreciate it. Jan in Racine emailed to say Jan's received, heard several people comment on flying squirrels at their bird feeders around Racine. Jan's wondering, how common are they in southeastern Wisconsin or anywhere else in the state? And what's the best way to attract them?
Well, they're reasonably common in most parts of the state. We have two species in the state, the southern flying squirrel, which is on the smaller side, a little bit bigger than a chipmunk with that big broad tail that they glide with and use as a rudder. And then there's a larger one up in the north that's become quite uncommon, the northern flying squirrel, which is quite a bit larger. But anyway, they're out there and relatively common, but they're about as strictly nocturnal as any Wisconsin animal, and most people are simply not out, you know, observing or seeing them when they're active in the middle of the night. When people do see them is when they put out a feeder, especially a shelf feeder or something that the squirrels can glide into from a surrounding tree and sit there and eat. So in terms of doing something for them, usually there's enough dead tree cavities and old nest boxes and things around that they can find nesting sites. But a bird feeder, well supplied with sunflower seeds and maybe some raw peanuts and assorted other things, would be very attractive to the squirrels. And if you can condition them to enough light that you can observe them, they're kind of fun to watch. They're cute little things. They have great big eyes and they're very soft and very attractive little animals. So if you get them and can see them, then you're lucky. Some people use a red filter on a spotlight. The red light doesn't seem to bother them as much as bright white light, and sometimes that'll help you get a good look at them or be able to observe them. So
that's pretty cool. That's a cool way to wind things up, Scott. Always a pleasure. Get out there and do a little more turkey hunting and a little more observing of nature, and we'll hear your next report in a couple of months. Thanks, Scott.
Sounds good, Larry. Bye-bye.
Scott Craven, our guest today for this Wildlife Wednesday, is a UW Extension wildlife ecologist, retired, and he's been talking with me on the air for many a year. It's always fun to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at a new dandy Wisconsin geology map. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, the last comprehensive map of the geology of Wisconsin was published almost 50 years ago. And now there's a new glacial geology map that shows what has happened over the past, 2.58 billion years or so. Larry Mueller here and a couple of guests who've been involved in this. J. Elmo Rowling is one of them. Elmo, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Hey, thanks, Larry.
And Eric Carson. Eric, welcome.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
These guys are quaternary geologists and professors in the UW-Madison Department of Extension. They work on the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, which just published a fascinating new map of our state's geology. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What do you know about the geologic history of Wisconsin, or what questions do you have about it? How did the landscape around us take shape? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, here's a question I bet you've had a few times. I said, well, I'm going to be talking with a couple of quaternary geologists. And the first thing out of the mouth was, what in the heck's a quaternary geologist? I said, all right, I'm going to ask that right off the bat. Elmo, you want to provide some information on that, maybe?
Sure. So the quaternary is a time period. It's the last 2.5-ish million years of Earth history, and it's a period of time where their climate is such that you can have glaciers at the poles and at high altitudes, so high latitudes and high altitudes. So it's sometimes called the Ice Ages. And the term is an old term. It goes back to very early geology, 1700s, right, where they were trying to parse out geologic time, and they had four time periods, and we were the fourth, the quaternary. So
quaternary,
that's where it comes from.
And I was pronouncing it wrong, too, so I should have looked that up before. No. Quaternary.
Yep.
All right, well, what's this new Wisconsin map show? I don't know. Eric, you want to talk about that?
Yeah. One of the things about this map is that we have different types of geologic maps. Very commonly, people think of maps as being geologic maps as being the solid bedrock. Yeah. And this one, because we're looking at this very recent period in Earth's history, we're looking at the unconsolidated sediment at the Earth's surface. So the glacial deposits and the river and wind deposits. So the soft sediment at the surface, and not the bedrock.
So this was a long time in decades in making.
The group that we put together, there were seven of us that are co-authors on it. Elmo and I are the two most junior of them. I believe between the seven of us, we had just over 250 years of combined experience looking at the quaternary geology of Wisconsin. Several of the people with 40 and 45-year careers.
Oh, my goodness me. And had been working on it for probably, well, they got started before you did, probably.
They were working on understanding the geology. It's just in the last 5 years that we got the federal resources to put this map together.
That's pretty cool. Elmo, what did each of you do to produce the map? I mean, is there everybody take a piece or what?
Yeah, so this map is based on maps that are produced at a scale that's of greater detail. So a lot of the state, our goal is to produce a map series of the whole state at 1 to 100,000 scale. And just to give listeners a sense, say Burnett County is 2 or 3 inches wide on this map. Burnett County would be 2 feet wide on a 1 to 100,000 scale map. So still pretty general, but more detailed than this. And we have about 3/4 of the state done. And so we can use that information to make this general compilation. And, you know, you need the geologists. You need the seven geologists that worked on it. But we also have cartographers. Caroline Rose was a cartographer for this. And, you know, the whole host of GIS staff, publishing team, people who manage our grants, people who archive material, manage databases at the Geologic Survey. So it takes a lot to do this with. And just this map itself, we've been working on since 2020.
Wow. And the time scale again, what was the time scale on this again?
So the quaternary is about the last 2.5 or 2.6 million years, which sounds like a long time, but obviously to geologists, it's less than half a blink of an eye.
And how do you, so I was really intrigued looking at them. It's a beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous map. But I was trying to figure out how would you illustrate, or how did you go about figuring out the ways to illustrate how those geologic forces formed Wisconsin?
Sure. So first of all, the sort of data sets that we use to make these maps include a lot of public information, like soil maps, the USDA soil maps we use. We use water well records. There's 800,000 water wells in the state, and those have some geologic information in them. We have high-resolution topographic maps now derived from LIDAR lasers from airplanes that give you centimeter scale or decimeters, you know, very high-resolution topographic information. And we compile all that in GIS in a digital environment, and then we also do our own coring, our own field work, our observations of driving around, looking at any exposures that we can find, and again, collecting cores that we target in areas that we want to develop.
And so a core, what's a core like?
So I collect a lot of those for my mapping work. We have two different coring mechanisms that we use that they're basically driving steel pipe down into the ground, and then you retrieve the sediment from the depth that you core down through. Some of them we typically go 40, 50 feet down into the ground to see what we have. And some of them we've gone as deep as, 400, 450 feet down through unconsolidated sediment. So we retrieve that and we bring it back to our core repository and describe it and photograph it and take samples for analysis, to really understand what's going on, not just right at the surface, but going down at some depth until we get to the solid bedrock.
So, then is there a way to age this? You've got a core, it probably looks like a long pipe of dirt.
Exactly.
Is probably what it looks like.
Yeah, for our cores, radiocarbon dating is one of our bread and butter techniques. If we're coring in the right setting, say an ancient lake basin, we'll find plenty of plant macrofossils to date. But we've got some more esoteric tools. We've got a dating methodology called optically stimulated luminescence excuse me, that dates how long a sand grain has been buried away from the sunlight.
And all those techniques are great when you can find the material to date. Eric's found a lot of material in the Driftless area. But when you get sort of behind the ice margin or up into northern Wisconsin, when the glaciers were here, there would have been permafrost conditions and very low vegetation. There's just not a lot of material to date. So we have a few things that are dated, but then we can look at, say, ice margin positions and say, well, this one is in front of that one, so it has to be older, and get a relative sequence of events that happened.
And I want to go back to Eric. You mentioned the Driftless area, and you're one of the first geologists to kind of work to focus on the Driftless area, I guess I could say.
Yeah, at the Geological Survey, we've got a very long history of glacial geologists that have worked there, and that makes sense since the majority of the state has been covered by ice. But the Driftless area is this part that was never covered by any of the many glaciations during the Quaternary period. And I am the first geologist at the Geological Survey who is trained to study that landscape. I was partly one of my graduate PhD advisors was a professor named Jim Knox from the geography department here. And he spent 43 years doing plenty of research in the Driftless area during his career in the geography department. But he didn't produce geologic maps. He produced a lot of peer-reviewed journal articles that might not be familiar to the general public. And so as part of our mandate and mission at the survey, we're looking to produce materials that have value for the citizens of the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and you know, what's coming to mind is, why do we do this? I mean, how is it used?
Well, this map is an outstanding teaching tool. It tells a broad story of the history of the state. Many of our maps that are more detailed we use for a whole host of land management decisions, or they are used for a whole host of land management decisions, where to locate roads, where to locate landfills, identifying water resources and contaminant probabilities, citing feed operations for agriculture to protect water resources. So our mapping feeds into a wide range of purposes.
It sounds like it. Elmo Rowling, our guest, one of our guests today, Eric Carson is the other. They are geologists and professors in the UW-Madison Department of Extension, focus on geology of Wisconsin with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. Questions or comments for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller talking with Elmo Rowling and Eric Carson, who are I'm going to mispronounce this again. I want to say quaternary, but it's not.
Quaternary.
Quaternary geologists. Quaternary, I got to get that right. Geologists, professors in the UW-Madison Department in Extension, they focus on the well, it's the quaternary in my mind.
There we go.
Geology of the state. And it's great to have them with us as we talk about this new map. And, you know, of course, we can take other questions relating to the geology of our state with these guys. They know what the heck they're doing, and they know a whole lot about it. So you can join in again, 800-642-1234. And let's take a call. John in Black Earth, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hello, sir.
What's up?
My question is, in every gravel pit from Black Earth to Dodgeville and along the road where they've cut through the rock, there is a gray-white band between 6 inches and a foot thick, about 10 feet down from the top, and no one can tell me what made that happen.
Is that in the sediment? It's not in the rock? Sometimes the quarries are rock, sometimes they're sediment. It sounds like sediment.
It is in the rock. It's a harder rock when you start picking at it, and I haven't called that many people or talked to that many people, but no one can tell me why it's that different color. You can visibly see it. I've taken pictures of it and sent it to geologists. I'm wondering if, like, a volcano went off a million years ago or what?
I don't know. Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, one of the quick problems with answering that is that there's so much topography in the Driftless area.
Yeah.
That as you go from Black Earth to any other place, you're going up and down through the rock layer. And so we're not exactly sure what layer that might be. And I think you could say that that's pretty far out of the quaternary, which makes it pretty tough for us to give an answer. You know, we're looking at layers of carbonate and sandstone there, so it very well could be a layer of carbonate that's heavily calcified that gives you that kind of banding look in it.
But I would say call this, you know, email us at the survey. We do have bedrock colleagues who work in the bedrock, and if we can't answer a question, we can usually find somebody, especially if you have pictures.
And yeah. we have colleagues that are doing bedrock geologic mapping in those counties in that part of the state right now. So we would have people in our office who could give a much better answer than I just did.
So how would they what's an email address? Or do you guys have a website that they can go to and John could send an email that way? Or?
Yes, if you Google WGNHS, that's for Wisconsin Geological or Natural History Survey, or just Wisconsin Geological Survey, you'll find our website. You can Google one of our names, and you'll probably find the Geologic Survey's website there, too.
And if you go to our staff page, it gives a one- or two-sentence brief about the work that we do. So there are people who are identified as bedrock geologists on our website.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned how many ice ages did we have in the Quaternary era?
Well, one of the problems with trying to figure out how many ice ages there were on land is that every time a glacier comes, it kind of erodes out the record from the previous glaciation. So people who do research in ocean settings kind of have a continuous sedimentation, and they come up with numbers like in the 20s over the last 20-ish glaciations in the last 2.5 million years. We have evidence for at least 3 in Wisconsin, one something around 800,000 years or older than that. And then we have a little bit of the Illinoisan glaciation in Wisconsin, but most of the state is covered in the last ice age, deposits of the last ice age, which was the late Wisconsin glaciation. And in fact, as Eric mentioned, there's always been glacial geologists in Wisconsin figuring this stuff out, and the last ice age is named after our state.
And the Driftless area was an area that was not glaciated or not as often glaciated?
To the best of our understanding, it was never glaciated.
And that's why it's got the cool topography.
It's got the cool topography. a good friend of mine just described it to me not too long ago as If you were to travel from Pittsburgh to Denver, driftless air is the only place with enough topography for you to fall off and die from it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you're biking out in that area,
you'll feel the burn.
You feel the burn. Although I've noticed compared to northern Wisconsin, biking up there, sometimes you've got some high hills, but then you go straight down. There, in the driftless area, you go up a long time, but then your downtime is long.
Yes.
And longer. Yes, yeah, I really like.
we're seeing a different suite of geologic processes there. We're seeing millions of years of wind and gravity and rivers sculpting the landscape, as opposed to the majority of the state that's covered by the Wisconsin glaciation that Elma talked about, that isn't anything more than 10 or 20,000 years old, landscape.
Yeah, pretty young by standards. Randy in New Auburn has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hey there. I live in New Auburn, and we have the Ice Age Trail running through here. We have a lot of perch lakes, and it seems like the glaciers kind of stopped moving through here, and it's Eau Claire area is kind of the area where the driftless kind of starts, and I'm wondering why you think the glaciers did not go through the middle of the state and why they conked out in this area.
Sure. So the recent thinking on that, so it's like, why do you have a driftless area, right, is most of the Great Lakes are a function or were formed during the ice ages. So Lake Michigan was probably a low river system that the glaciers took advantage of and flowed into and carved out a lake basin. But the Lake Superior Basin is a much older basin. It's a rift basin that is older than a billion years with a B. And so there's always been some low area there. And when the glaciers enter Wisconsin, ice is diverted a little bit to the southwest from that basin. You have to fill that basin. You have to get up and over a bedrock divide to spill into northern Wisconsin. And you just don't have enough time to get all the way to the driftless area, I think is the most recent kind of thinking on that.
Yeah. And when we think about how glaciers flow compared to water, water flows by gravity. Glaciers actually don't. They flow by the pressure of ice behind them from the center of the ice mass, pushing them forward. So ice can flow uphill. So ice coming out of the Green Bay lowlands came all the way down here to Madison. And ice coming down the Lake Michigan lowlands flowed all the way down into Illinois. But the Lake Superior Basin is just such a deep trough, and it's oriented perpendicular to the ice flow, that it was just an incredible impediment to ice flowing any farther south than it did.
Randy, does that help?
That's awesome. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess follow-up question is, why are there so many perch lakes up here north of Eau Claire in the Chippewa County?
Northern Wisconsin, the distribution of like clays and sand and gravel is very heterogeneous. There's a lot of variability in the subsurface. There's a lot of variability at the surface, and so there's times when as the ice is melting, that there's ponding that is then filled in with younger sediment, and so you have a lot of variability, possibly older lake sediment that are impeding that water from getting flowing deeper into the aquifer systems. Huh. I would guess.
Yeah, it makes sense. Randy, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Dennis in Stoughton, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. The question I had was, I live in Stoughton and along the Hare River and the Madison drainage from the lakes is at a specific level. And yet I have a history book here on the history of Stoughton, and it talks about having to go 250 feet down to hit bedrock when they were drilling a well. So my understanding is that whole valley, this river system is really floating way above its natural course if it was indeed down at the bedrock before the glaciation. Am I picturing that right?
You absolutely are. The topography that we think of in the driftless area of this branching pattern of streams carving down into the bedrock, that actually exists all the way across southern Wisconsin. It's just that once you get behind the glacial margin, a lot of that topography is filled in with glacial sediment. And so the Yahara River today, there is a much deeper valley, the ancestral Yahara River Valley, that the Four Lakes of Madison sit in that old low depression And much of the depression is filled by very young glacial sediment. And yeah, the caller is exactly correct that the modern river is sitting perched hundreds of feet up above where the ancient river flowed before the glacial deposits filled it in.
That's really cool. Really cool. Dennis, thank you so much for calling. I wanted to be sure to remember to ask you about the how people can get copies of this map, and you can go online and take a look at it. And but Elmo, what about that?
Sure. The Geologic Survey used to sell hard copies of maps, and then the internet came along, and you started posting digital copies of maps for free. And when you post a digital copy of a map for free, and then say or buy for $20, people download the free one. And so our map sales plummeted. And I would guess 5 years ago or longer, the Geologic Survey stopped printing hard copies of maps, and now everything that we have is available digitally as a PDF for free, and along with the data. So there is map data that you can download as well and put in a GIS and look that way if you have that software or that expertise. But that is a hard, for us who make the maps, that is a hard a topic that hurts our hearts.
Yeah. I'd pay the $20 for one of these maps.
It's worth having it if you can get it. You know, download the PDF, find a print shop that can do large format.
Because
printing.
Yeah, this is a larger thing we're talking about here.
It's 42 inches, I think, tall and 46 wide. So that's pretty big. That's to get it to print it at the scale that it's intended to be printed at.
Yeah, and that would make a lot of sense. I'm wondering. I think the Ice Age Trail came up earlier. Somebody was talking about the trail. And that might be useful for folks who are traveling on the trail. I mean, wouldn't it? Does it follow the edge of the glacial deposits across the state?
The trail, yeah. Yes, yeah. Most of it. And then you can, there are instructions on our website for downloading the PDF. It is geolocated. There are software programs where you can view it in your phone in real, like where you are, right? And it'll follow you around. So you can do that as well.
So I would think this would be really cool for hikers then.
Yes, and we always caveat, you know, this is meant to be the whole state at 42 inches.
Yeah.
So when you zoom into where you are, there may be some inconsistencies, right? So it's a generalized map, but yes.
So how much more work have you got to do? I mean, you got this map. What's next?
Oh, I'm continuing to map in northwestern Wisconsin. I'm working on Burnett County, Bayfield County, Price, and Sawyer counties at the moment. Just wrapped up a project for the U.S. Forest Service. Forest Service wanted their Shawmagon, portion of the Shawmagon-Nicolet Forest hadn't been mapped. And then Eric?
Yeah, so I've got several projects going on that are funded by the U.S. Geological Survey. So I'm doing the more detailed 100,000 scale mapping. Currently, I'm working in Jackson and Trempealeau counties, and I'm about to start working in Buffalo, Pepin, and Pierce. So over the last 15 years, I've basically mapped the entire Driftless area at that scale, starting at the south and moving north. So coming to the end of my arc of mapping in the Driftless area.
That's all pretty cool. And again, how do we get the map? Where do you go online to get the map?
You want to go to the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey's website.
And I'm sure there's a spot where you can see this latest one.
There'll be a tab for both publications and a tab for new publications. So you'll be able to find it right there fairly prominently.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun talking about it. Thanks. You guys.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. J. Elmo Rowling and Eric Carson. Quaternary. I got it right. Just finally, right at the end. Geologists and professors with Extension at UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us. Take a look at that map. It is really, really something and fun to talk with them about it. And it's always fun to sit down and talk with my own team from time to time. We got our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, And our executive producer, kind of the boss, Jill Nadeau. I'm just here to talk once in a while on the show. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.